And welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Hour three, as we begin, as we began in the middle of last hour, I wanted to say that you are intelligent, you are gracious and patient, and you are able to love with a power and influence that's felt across the universe, and yet you are afraid. Why? Your voices, when joined together, are more powerful and immovable than any weapon ever designed. You can create anything you desire. And I would maintain that you have done just that. The messages left by the explorers and dreamers of past civilizations have gotten to us. We have only discussed a few of them in this program tonight. Now, can you set aside the hunger for your next paycheck for just an hour or so to discuss the future of the human race? Can you reach a little further than a single lifetime into the future like our ancestors did and try to bring something back to the present instead of leaving something written in the sand that will only be washed away with the most innocuous ripple of water? Bring it back to now, so we can take a step in a different direction. In reviewing ancient technologies, we were talking about the Vimanas. I have to tell you, there seems to be no doubt that Vimanas were powered by some sort of anti-gravity. They took off vertically, and they were capable of hovering in the sky like a helicopter or a dirigible. One of the ancients in Indian Vedic texts, his name was Bharadvaji, the wise, refers to no less than 70 authorities and 10 experts of air travel in antiquity. And these sources are now lost. Like John was talking about Mr. Bueller's energy membranes that we pass through that may drop this forgetting upon us, filter out those memories. All we need to do is remember. The Vimanas were kept in a Vimana Girha, a kind of hangar, and they were sometimes said to be propelled by a yellowish-white liquid and sometimes by some sort of mercury compound, though writers seem confused in this matter. It is most likely that the later writers on Vimanas wrote as observers and from earlier texts and were understandably confused on the principle of their propulsion. The yellowish-white liquid sounds suspiciously like gasoline, and perhaps Vimanas had a number of different propulsion sources, including combustion engines and even pulse jet engines, which would have run on something like kerosene. It is interesting to note that the Nazis developed the first practical pulse jet engines for their V-8 rocket, buzz bombs. These were the V-1 rockets, by the way. And Hitler and the Nazi staff were exceptionally interested in the ancient India and in Tibet and sent expeditions to both of these places yearly, starting in the 1930s. I'm sure they came across the stupas that were designed in the likeness of a Tesla coil. Of course, Tesla in the early 1900s developed his coils and was able to master great amounts of energy and even perhaps demonstrated bending space-time and causing invisibility. In order to gather esoteric evidence that they did so, perhaps it was from these people that the Nazis gained some of their scientific information. According to the Dronaparva, part of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, one Vimana described was shaped like a sphere and borne along at great speed on a mighty wind generated by Mercury. It moved like a UFO, going up and down, backwards and forwards, as the pilot desired. In another Indian source, the Samar Vimanas were iron machines, well knit and smooth, with a charge of mercury that shot out of the back in the form of a roaring flame. By the way, that's how our fluorescent lighting works. We use a drop of mercury, we excite it into the plasma state using a shot of high voltage electricity, usually borne by a small capacitor. Once it goes into plasma, it takes very little energy to keep it in that state. We just bounce the electrons up to the next energy state, and when they come back down, they issue forth an ultraviolet photon. That ultraviolet photon strikes the powder, which is on the inside of the glass, affectionately called dope. And when the photon strikes that powder, the powder then emits light in the visible range. Ultraviolet, of course, you cannot see. But the dope on the inside of the light not only absorbs the ultraviolet light, making the fluorescent light perfectly safe for long-term exposure, but it puts out wavelength in the visible range. Now, some of the dopes have been very well engineered. Some of them put off a soft blue, some of them kind of a light pink, and there are even those that put off what's called daylight, which is takes a little bit more energy. You can't just put a daylight bulb in a regular fixture. You can for a while, but what will happen is the ballast won't keep it lit because it requires more power. Usually about 40 or 50 watts or 70 watts in a light fixture that's normally capable of putting out 25 to 40 watts, and so you burn up the ballast. But you will get nice bright white light for a while. That's how fluorescent lighting works, and for these ships to put out a blast out the back using mercury leads me to believe that they were probably plasma driven. Curiously, Soviet scientists have discovered what they call age-old instruments used in navigating cosmic vehicles in caves in Turkestan and in the Gobi Desert. The devices are hemispherical objects of glass or porcelain ending in a cone with, you guessed it, a drop of mercury inside. It is evident that ancient Indians flew around in these vehicles all over Asia to Atlantis, presumably, and even apparently to South America. Writing found at the Mohenjo-daro in Pakistan, presumably to be one of the seven Rishi cities of the Rama Empire, and still undeciphered, has also been found in one other place in the world, Easter Island. Writing on Easter Island, called Rongopongo writing, is also undeciphered and is uncannily similar to the Mohenjo-daro script. Was Easter Island an airbase for the Rama Empire? It's hard to say, but it is, located in a nice way station area out there. Rama Airways flight number 7 for Bali, Easter Island, Nazca, and Atlantis is now ready for boarding. Yeah, I'll bet they probably didn't use it for the average person. It looks like, especially when you go into places like Abydos in Egypt, if you get a chance to go there, you definitely should. It's not an easy trip. You would leave by bus out of probably Luxor. And you would head toward Nag Hammadi. When you get to that military checkpoint, you would turn left and go out to Abydos. It's a pretty good bus ride, and you got to go with a caravan. It's not one where you rent a car or a motorcycle and head off on your own. But when you get there, look as you enter, look up in the ceiling. You'll notice the heavy beams that hold up the stone ceiling are quite ornate. And sure enough, carved into one of those beams, now this goes back to Seti I, which this building would have been fairly new in the days of Christ. In the ceiling is a rendition, a copy, of several aircraft, which are carved right into the ceiling, right into the beam. And many, many pictures are out there. Actually, there's probably only two or three on the internet out there. I took about 20 pictures of it, different lighting. You can't use a flash. And it is up in the ceiling where there isn't any light, so you really have to wait for optimum daylight conditions, which sometimes are not possible in that part of the country. It's kind of overcast and hazy sometimes. You can get a pretty good shot of it, and I have several, and it's a little bit clearer than the one that's on the internet that you go out there and look at Vimanas. That's what you're going to find. But some look like helicopters, some like jet planes, some like tanks, and some look a little bit like the Jetsons vehicle that they zoomed around in on the cartoon show. Unfortunately, Vimanas, like most scientific discoveries, were ultimately used for war. Atlanteans used their flying machines, Vailixi, a similar type of aircraft, to literally try and subjugate the world, it would seem, if Indian texts are to be believed. The Atlanteans, known as Asvins, in the Indian writings, were apparently even more advanced technologically than the Indians, and certainly of a more warlike temperament. Although no ancient texts on Atlantean Vailixi are known to exist, some information has come down through esoteric, quote, occult sources, which describe their flying machines, similar, if not identical, to Vimanas. Now, Vailixi were generally cigar-shaped and had the capability of maneuvering underwater as well as in the atmosphere or even in outer space. Other vehicles, like Vimanas, were saucer-shaped and could apparently also be submerged. By the way, USOs, undersea objects, unidentified, of course, are quite plentiful. They come up out of the water and zoom up into the sky and go plasma and disappear. And some have been recorded by military observers and tracked on radar, coming out of the water, achieving Mach 8, and going straight out into space. I'm sure quite alarming to Navy seamen who might be on the boat plodding along at 10 or 12 or 15 knots to see something come out of the water like that would be very, very shocking. The point is that we have an ancient society, an ancient civilization, at least one, maybe two, that had advanced flying machines, and it appears that they did not use them for public transportation the way we do. We at least have that much peaceably on them. Most airplanes in the world today are used for public transportation. You buy a ticket, you sit in a nice, comfortable seat, you put some music on your head, you have a controlled atmosphere on the inside. If you're very lucky, you'll get a bag of peanuts, and you arrive at your destination with barely a wrinkle in your clothes. Unless, of course, you're flying to overseas, to Europe or to China. If you fly to China, you can watch all the movies and eat all the food, and you still have 5-6 hours to go. So it's a long, long flight, and you will definitely have wrinkles in your clothes and probably some of your body parts, too, by the time you get there. But nevertheless, these are not warplanes, and the vast majority, hundreds of thousands of flights every single month, take place for peaceful purposes on this planet, and that's the way it should be. Now, in ancient times, it appears that these craft were basically and primarily used for warfare. They were used for high-speed assault, high-speed defense, and maybe for military exploration and surveillance, but not for general public transportation. Now, it would seem that there was a pattern to go by. It would seem that our government and the governments, the military governments of the world, have craft that they fly that the public never gets to ride in. We'll never see it. We might look up and say, wow, what was that flying at Mach 10 across the sky? And it's ours. it has our markings on it, or it has UN markings on it, or something like that. These are even more advanced aircraft. But I can tell you this much. As a former member of the United States Air Force, albeit not much, just a simple E-4, I can tell you that the military, the general rank and file military, does not have as advanced technology as the private sector. We are some years behind in that. But the advanced areas of the military do have the latest stuff. Why? Because it's their money that developed it. So the radios and the tools and the diagnostic equipment that we have as far as electronics is a little aged. If you come out of the Air Force, you're going to have some training to be sure. But it's going to be 3 to 5, maybe even more years behind the private sector. The private sector moves at a much, much faster pace, unless it comes to weaponry. Then you're talking about very, very advanced systems, surveillance systems and flying systems and ability to surveil from outer space. And now it appears kill from outer space. So we want to progress as a race. We want to grow beyond that. So I'm asking you to help me dream a little bit tonight. You can call in at 415-762-1161. Call in and share a vision of what you have seen for the future. Believe me, it's important. If you have been out there in the future and seen a possibility of a future, I'd like to hear about it tonight. 415-762-1161. Now, I don't want you to call in and say, yes, I saw Armageddon. We wipe each other out. There's a nuclear winter. And let's try to keep it a little positive. Let's talk about social visions or even technological visions that have some kind of positive twist to it. Because I have a reason for doing this. I believe that if we share this dream, it adds a little bit of energy to it, and it raises its possibility, as Amit Goswami would say, of becoming a reality. So what have you dreamed out there? What have you seen in your meditations that has shown you we can rise above the warrior inside us and become the explorer? So speaking of exploring, we have talked from time to time about the Themis probes. Themis was a set of probes, 5 of them, put in a single capsule, launched out into space in 2007. And it was interesting what they were sent up to do. They discovered that the northern lights are seen when electrical tornadoes rotating faster than 1,000,000 miles an hour hover about 40,000 miles above the Earth. The energy spins down to the Earth's ionosphere, where the tornadoes become unstable and interact with the Earth's magnetic field. Despite a lack of empirical evidence, like interaction with satellites, the public reports go unchallenged in mainstream science. Professor Karl Heinz Glassmeyer, director of the Institute for Geophysics and Extraterrestrial Physics in Braunschweig, Germany, explains, "When these space tornadoes reach the upper atmosphere, their enormous energy heats the air so strongly it starts glowing. That is what generates the aurorae. It is here that all the energy is released, forming the aurorae. What we see as beautiful lights and colors are actually the product of a violent electrical storm in space. While these electrical discharges do not cause any direct harm to humans, they can damage man-made structures, such as power transformers and communication system," said Andreas Keiling, a physicist at the University of California at Berkeley. Time, history of events, and macro-scale interactions during substorms are 5 probes, the Themis probes, launched by NASA in February of 2007. They orbit the Earth, recording the volume and electrical current, which was higher than 100,000 amps. 100,000 amps, that's a lot of current. Those of you that remember the dynamo experiment, where The shuttle was sent up and a tether was stretched out several tens of miles in order to try to measure the moving space shuttle, moving that tether through the magnetic field to see what kind of current could be realized. And the tether, although made of Kevlar, exploded. There was far more energy surrounding the space shuttle than what was expected. I question the space tornadoes, though. You know, the Themis probes only orbit about 200 to 400 miles out into space. That's it. The fact that the five line up every now and then where they're able to take a reading sort of like a string of pearls out into space. The first paper that came out said that there was a cosmic bullet between satellites 3 and 4. It passed 4 and 5 heading out for space, 3, 2, and 1 heading for Earth, and lo and behold, there was an aurora. They have no idea where the bullet came from. Not in reality. They said it was magnetic ropes left behind by the sun. Even though it's 93 million miles away, yes, we're in its gravitational pull, but the magnetism from the sun doesn't stretch out that far. Now they're talking about electrical tornadoes 40,000 miles out into space, far beyond the scope of the Themis probes, to be sure. Now, scientists had previously concluded that the aurorae were caused by electrically charged particles discharged as solar winds from the sun, which interact with the Earth's magnetic field. However, these solar discharges strike the Earth where the sun is shining, and the aurora occur in the opposite hemisphere and are visible in the night sky. Those of you that don't know what they're talking about here, the Earth is tilted on a 23-degree angle on its axis. So the sunward side of the Earth during the season when we see the auroras is the side of the Earth facing away from the sun. And so that, coupled with the picture that they revealed that there were auroras over both poles at the same time, it still has not been addressed by publications relating to the Themis probes. In other words, the official reports do not explain the dual auroras that have been observed. Additionally, the space tornado theory has not affected any orbiting satellite. No transmission has been upset by these electrical tornadoes. In short, I think it's a fancy news release. I don't really think we have a reading on electrical space tornadoes. The evidence shows that the auroras are at least an interaction between forces that are inside the Earth and not necessarily forces that are outside the Earth. This is profound. Very profound, because what it implies directly by the empirical evidence is that there is a charged body on the inside of the Earth rotating at least a different RPM than the crust of the Earth, thus causing this very strong magnetic field, which we know as our magnetosphere. But when we see these counter-rotating bodies in space, and the very largest of them are called quasars, we see highly accelerated jets of particles at the poles, straight out the north and south of that pole, a lot like the pranic tube that goes parallel to, or at least congruent with, the human spine. Coming out the base of the spine and the top of the spine, that would be the root and the crown chakras, we also theorize and have measured energy coming out of the human body, much like it comes out of the quasar, especially in times when a Merkaba field can be rotated by the intention and concentration of that person. Now, if that is the case, then we are not talking about a molten ball of lava floating through space upon which we live, on a cornflake floating around in a bowl of milk. so to speak. That means that we have a solid core and we have a solid crust. They're both complete with gravitational mass, and they're counter-rotating against each other. And this is what causes the ion flow out the north and south poles of the Earth. Now, that interaction with the right conditions of the atmosphere is what causes the aurora. And it's not going to be corroborated by a space-based probe, except to prove that the effect is not caused from space alone. It is also caused by this force on the inside of the Earth, which would support something like hollow Earth theory. Very interesting. One more case. Why we need to go to the North Pole and take some measurements. Come on, let's go. Let's do it. So, in the spirit of exploration, some things have happened in the last few weeks of which we have been involved. And I'd say it was about 3 weeks ago, someone released, I think it was Brown, released a nighttime video taken of some digging going on near the Sphinx. Now, people, when you're shooting nighttime videos, please remember to turn your video camera to infrared. Almost every Sony camera, most of the Canon cameras, and most of the Kodak cameras have a night vision function. Now, it's not going to take a photograph or a film that you would recognize invisible light, more than likely. You're going to get heat signatures from it in the infrared band, not the visible band. But at nighttime, this is the kind of filming that you have to do if you're going to get some kind of detail. Now, this video was shot of excavation and digging that was going on in and around in front of the Sphinx. Now, this is independent of the Red Bull event that just took place. Those of you that were able to watch it on television, you can watch it on the internet if you want, a BMX Red Bull event. Who could imagine building bicycle ramps in front of Giza? But that's what they did. Next to it was another dig, where they had excavated down about 40 feet, maybe four stories, something like that, had gotten to a certain level and dug a shaft, which by my estimation is about 24 feet by 24 feet, shored up with wood and with sandbags. Now, what was claimed in this video is that items were being removed from under the ground, and we really couldn't see what they were. Now, there were some drawings around it, but, you know, it's kind of like the movie of a UFO at night. It's a little fuzzy. It's a little bit out of focus. It's not really well done, not like Hollywood would do it. And so all it really did is stir people up and make people start talking, until one of my colleagues, who happened to be in Egypt, got access to the area during the daytime. Yes, during the daytime, and shot 20 photographs. Very clear, almost clear enough where you could see the people's faces that were working on it. And we published those pictures, keeping the identity of the person secret at that person's request. So those pictures hit Facebook and went from profile to profile around the world. They've been viewed tens of thousands of times in the last 2 weeks. And now the truth is out. There's a dig going on in front of the Sphinx. And based on one of the photographs there, it looks like something or things have been crated up in wooden crates. We don't know if they're being hauled to a museum or not, but one has the suspicion that although this is a sanctioned dig, that is to say, somebody high up is in on the know, because it's happening right in front of the Sphinx, and they have another event which had a small amount of excavation and some scaffolding set up and some equipment set up going on right next to it, and it appears to be kind of a cover for it. So the conspiracies are flying, let me tell you. But a picture is worth 10,000 words, especially a daytime picture. And believe me, the eyes of the world are upon this area, and rightfully so. Because the fact that the world's most important archaeological site was being excavated in the first place without the world press involved is absolutely unthinkable. The suspicion that something was being removed that might date back to the 25th dynasty or before was hair-raising and shocking to the archaeological community. Now, claims that the water table was threatening the structure's integrity and the site had to be relieved of the water and some shafts had to be dug to kind of shore up the area. I'm not a geologist. I am somewhat of an architect. I would say, no pun intended, doesn't hold water for me. I'm not buying it. Not digging a shaft like that, not having those kinds of individuals, they look like Western Europeans or even Americans, standing around the dig, and I would venture to say that if I had the high resolution of the photograph up, you would be able to recognize who these people were. But as you know, we use flash and we use low resolution, so you can't get that kind of detail. But you can clearly see that something is going on. And I have personally have pictures of larger earth-moving equipment coming out of the desert to the west of Cairo in the area speculated to be Memphis or the outskirt of ancient Heliopolis. And my question is, what were they doing out there? Were they building roads across the largest ancient city in the world? Sure, why not? I doubt it, seriously. But I can tell you, as nations inherit land and inherit the artifacts that are upon that land, they claim ownership. The indigenous peoples of North America have enjoyed no less. Even now, in Alberta, Canada, there is an ancient solar observatory that spans a diameter of more than a mile. It has been documented, photographed, it's been measured and confirmed by numerous years of sun tracking, yet the government of Canada refuses to acknowledge its existence. Why? This site is more than 5,000 years old. Why? Because the government of Canada also controls all the oil exploration in Alberta. And the listing of an ancient site of this quality would inhibit the free and unfettered drilling for oil in these areas. So it will not be listed or studied officially. It's a remote location west of, and I didn't make this up, west of Brooks, Alberta. Scientist Gordon Freeman, he's a commercial chemist. I met him myself. I watched his demonstration. I saw his photographs. I listened to his very meticulous study. And he discovered a sun temple that predates Stonehenge. According to Freeman, it was constructed some 5,000 years ago by the Oxbow people and contains a solar calendar like ours, but slightly more accurate. He states that the site also contains a detailed lunar calendar. He also states that every single calendar that we use on the Earth today was formed by a religion, and they're all wrong. During field work in England from 1986 to the year 2006, Freeman found striking similarities between the surface geometries of Stonehenge and this site, findings which have far-reaching historical implications. These discoveries are carefully documented and interpreted in Gordon Freeman's new book, and this book is called Canada's Stonehenge. It's a hardbound book. The photography is stunning. The study is very meticulous. Canada's Stonehenge. It's subtitled Astounding Archaeological Discoveries in Canada, England, and Wales. So it actually spans a period of 5,000 years, and as you know, the sun, the equinoxes, march across the zodiac, and over a period of 5,000 years, that equinox, even though it shifted, it was marked every 500 years by this observatory. This calendar actually had stones put in place to mark the new equinoxes every 500 years. That's how long it's been there. That's how long it's been used. You can see it from the air very clearly. From the ground, it's so large in diameter, it's difficult to see. But he carefully went out there in the dead of winter and in the summer, setting up his cameras, taking pictures a few days before, right on, and a few days after those equinoxes. And it is stunning how accurate it really is. My question is, who are we, really? I mean, how long have we been here? How long has the human race been here? And, you know, we're not knuckle-dragging Neanderthals. We're not Cro-Magnons floating around with the honeybees following the crop and chasing herds with wooden sticks. We're not making fire by rubbing two sticks together or slapping two stones together and blowing on a leaf and wearing animal skins. These are intelligent, mathematically adept astronomers who have built amazing stargazing, lunar gazing, and solar gazing equipment. Why? Did they do it for a hobby? Did some lone scientist misplaced out of time go out there in the middle of Brooks, Alberta, Canada, and set up stones over a mile in diameter to measure the sun? I doubt it. I think it was important for them to know where the sun was and how it was moving. If the sun moved or something was late, it wasn't just when to plant and when to harvest. They knew if something went out of kilter, a cataclysm was coming. Now, the Maya appeared to spend most of their wealth in technology and manpower on leaving a message for us, not for them. They didn't do it for them. They left it for us. Now, did their desires leave a legacy that awakens us? Or does it just make it curious? Do we just get on a tour bus and go down there and say, how interesting that was? Let's go out to eat tonight. Or do we realize that these designs weren't trial and error? They were done right the first time. And they were done right so that we would see that they had this forethought. And they weren't looking for the end of their year. They were looking for our day. And I'm sure individually, well, no, wait, I was going to make a declarative statement there. I was going to say that they didn't think that they would live until now. They weren't building it for themselves, thinking that they would be alive in the 21st century to see these things line up the way they had predicted. But maybe they did believe that. Maybe they did know that they would be alive at this time, and that they would remind them who they were and where they came from. You know, the race that built the pyramids certainly at least had a fascination with the Sirian star system. The ancient peoples of North America measured the stars and the moon with astonishing accuracy, as you can tell by Gordon Friedman's study. Why? What were they waiting for? Or were they waiting for someone? Did they want to be ready when a certain date arrived? Well, if they packed for a departure, they did an amazing job because they left no one and nothing behind but their buildings. It has been said that if we left today, just got on a ship and left Earth, those of us that know how to do stuff, our legacy would return to dust within 10,000 years. Barely a blink of the cosmic eye, I would say. So we would drift into ignominy as quickly as they did. Fortunately, some of the things that they built were out of solid granite. It takes the winds of time and the ebb of seas and the quake of earth a long time to take something built to take the beating to fall to the ground. It didn't. It stayed. It lasted. And maybe, just maybe, those structures are igniting, awakening, turning on, really blazing some message inside of us, like in the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The character played by Richard Dreyfuss, driven nearly insane by his visions of the Devil's Tower, making them out of everything from mashed potatoes to a garden shrubbery. And finally, he made the connection and followed the invitation. Are you being driven the same way? Are you having the same visions? That's a question worth asking yourself. As we explore this planet, we learn a little bit about where we came from, why we're here. We learn a little bit about the concentration, or at least the focal point of ancient peoples. And you wonder, just look at it from a project management standpoint. You don't even have to look at it from an engineer's standpoint. You don't even have to look at it from a scientist's standpoint. You're a project engineer, and you're going to the leaders of the state who are trying to keep social, political, and economic control of their particular society. And you come up with an idea. You want to build a building. And I'm sorry to say, but it's going to take longer than your lifetime to build it. How do you get a leader involved in that? Oh, and by the way, it's not really to your legacy. We're leaving a message for people that are going to be born 1,500 years from now that the planet is going to be lined up with this galactic plane in the galaxy, and it's really important because they might be bombarded with these dark particles in space, and they might have to take some precautions. So we need to build something that's sort of like a giant granite cartoon because we can't leave it in a language. Our language won't be preserved for that long. They're not going to be able to understand what we mean. So we have to leave it in some kind of structure that they will understand, that will wake them up, that will make them as a people, a population, a race, realize that they've got to get their act together or they're going to go extinct. Or that is to say, we're going to go extinct. Because we're born again and again and again. And I, as an engineer, for one, I'm going to be alive in that day and I want to survive. I want to make it off this planet, or I want to go with the planet wherever it goes. But we got to be ready. We can't just go through life doing the same things we were doing, living from paycheck to paycheck, family vacation to family vacation. We can't save up some stupid 401k and buy all the toys thinking it's going to make us happy. That's not the purpose of life at all. We got to let them know. And so they build these amazing edifices to let us know. But unfortunately, they are inherited by short-minded men who are willing to dig in the dark of night to discover secretly what lies or lay beneath the earth and spirit it away in wooden crates, where mankind will never know. I hate to sound like Indiana Jones, but I, for one, believe it belongs in a museum. We need to see it. We need to know what came out of there, because it might be something for us. It might be a message. In fact, it might be a message left by you, or you, or even you. And maybe you need that message. Maybe you left it behind for yourself. That's my reasoning. That's my take on it. And this is X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We will see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. And hey, don't enjoy the summer too much out there. You know, there's a lot of solar radiation going out there. And if you're staying out there to the point where your skin turns red, it's not a good thing. It'll catch up with you eventually. Race week coming up here in the eastern part of the country. Charlotte Motor Speedway tomorrow starts all the qualification races. You'll be able to see it on television. Don't forget that you could pick up the ebook of Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. You could pick up the ebook by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Buy the ebook. It's less than $8. You could read that. You get all the photographs in color, all the drawings and illustrations in color. And then when the printed version comes out in less than 40 days now, you'll get 25% off of that. You can have it on your library shelf and already have the knowledge in your head. We're running out of time here, so I'm trying to get it in your hands. Also, I'll be presenting at the eSETI conference. This is July 4th weekend, Trout Lake, Washington. Go sign up for it. If you're within a day's drive, you have no excuse. If you haven't seen a UFO, here's the place. Go to Trout Lake, Washington. You can get there. Go to eSETI, ECETI.org, and register. By the way, those of you from the Questers up there in Calgary, Canada, where we had our meeting, thank you so much for your wonderful hospitality, for your great spirits of exploration. And if you're listening to this as an archive, I want you to feel my heartfelt gratitude. I was treated with a great dignity and respect, and I appreciate it. Your hospitality was unmatched. And to Olds College, what a great facility up there in Olds, Alberta. Just a wonderful facility, an agricultural college, well-built, great hospitality, great food, wonderful stargazing. Bless you all with long life. Continue to search for the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day, and before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.